Wakey, wakey. Eggs and bakey.
It's time for an unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smart.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice.
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwaveable macaroni and cheese dinner that people sold it on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories. That's a gluten. Fat. That's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Filled protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat's back on my menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloth and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
Good morning and welcome to an unbalanced breakfast here on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. And speaking of an unbalanced breakfast today, so far this morning, I've only had chocolate chip cookies and some coffee.
I'm
doing well.
I've had coffee, so I have a completely balanced
Clearly
breakfast.
The nutrition students are great role models right now.
Well, it's early, you know.
It is. As evidenced by the fact that there's still no show in front of us, but that makes it easy for us.
Yeah, it does.
So, very cool show today. We'll be opening up with some news from the past week in nutrition. And then we have a very exciting guest today.
Yes.
For those of you who attended the Gershoff Symposium over at Friedman yesterday, part of the alumni weekend, Dr. David Katz was the keynote speaker, and he will be calling in for the middle portion of the show. So we'll be talking to him, asking him some questions. So that is pretty awesome. And then we're going to be closing with another quiz around the topic of cannibalism.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll talk about it later, but you joked about it a couple weeks ago with Curtis. And
if you remember, I was in line, actually, to buy a salad, and my friend was like, oh, you study nutrition? Okay, here's my question, cannibalism. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, this isn't what I expected, but... Yeah.
But we researched it.
So Matt researched it.
Mm-hmm. It was awesome. All right, so if you want to...
I only partially approved, I wanted to say.
Yeah, the show and the school, nobody is endorsing the practice of cannibalism.
No, or me.
Ritualistic, either. Nutritionally or otherwise.
No.
So if you want to call in here, the phone lines are open, just made sure. We had some problems last week, but the number here is 617-627-3800. You can also hit us on Twitter, at Boxman37 or NutritionWonk.
Awesome.
So, Catherine, why don't you get us started off with some news?
Yeah, so there was a really interesting story that came out this week on Stat News, which was, which you can check out on Stat News, or you can read
Stat's
a little.
Stat's great.
I love Stat.
It has unfortunate ownership, but yes, Stat's great.
Is it Boston Globe, right, that owns it?
Yeah, Mr. John Henry.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Matt doesn't like Stat, but yeah, I love Stat News, and if you don't get their... if you don't get their daily kind of email, for sure sign up, but it's mostly health news. So they had an article coming out that basically, I'll read the headline for you. It was Disney fearing scandal tried to press journal to withdraw a research paper. This is really an interesting idea. So
wait till you hear who the journalist was. I heard the researcher was.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So, basically, what happened is Disney wanted to do a study. They funded a study to look at whether or not the changes that they made in their meals that they sold to kids were effective. So, essentially, what they did was they made healthy sides, the default choice, and then if parents wanted to get their kids soda or fries, they would have to ask for them instead of having it be the default. So, a really cool idea. And then they just wanted to test, well, how effective is this? How is this affecting the nutrition? the outcomes came out. Outcomes were fine. They showed that there was a, you know, essentially a benefit. So why would Disney maybe not want the study to be published? Well, interestingly, Disney funded one of the main authors was James Hill, Dr. James Hill, and of the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And you might have heard of him because he was on the board of directors for the ill-fated Global Energy Balance Network, which was the nonprofit scientific research organization that was funded entirely by Coca-Cola. And so that had a major kind of scandal this summer when it was broken in the New York Times that the major funder for this new research network was going to be Coca-Cola. And the focus of the research, it was quote-unquote energy balance. So the idea, you know, the idea of exercise for energy balance, which is something that Coca-Cola has been kind of very consistently pushing. This idea that if you exercise enough, you can burn off all the calories you eat or drink, So, so it's just really interesting because I think Walt Disney realized, oh, they might have a PR problem because they're a really, really, really big company funding a scientific study. And it's kind of what's kind of really interesting about it to me is that it's sort of come like completely full circle from researchers or the public being wary of taking money from industry for research because they're worried that it's going to make the research look bad, to it circling all the way back and having the industry being afraid of funding research because it's going to make the industry look bad. And so you kind of have a series of unintended consequences here. And it's and I think, you know, it's a little unfortunate because you what we really don't want is for people to be afraid to fund science. But I think a lot of times what happens is that because these industries have, they don't have control over the outcomes or the methodology per se, but they can strongly influence the research questions. You have a lot of questions revolving around, well, how ethical is this research? And what kind of questions are being asked? Are these really the questions we need to ask about health and nutrition? Or are these the questions that are, you know, going to be in the best interest of the industry to ask? And I think for this particular one about if we change kids' meals at Disney, is it going to improve health? I think that's actually kind of just an interesting question in general. I think that a lot of fast food places are trying to make similar changes. So I think the idea of the efficacy of that is definitely interesting. But I don't know. What do you think? Did you have any thoughts about the whole funding kind of fiasco?
Well, I thought it was just interesting in general because Disney is not known for its great practices, I guess you would say, in terms of its employees and things like that. A lot of shady business has been associated with Disney, so I just thought it was interesting that they would be taking maybe the lead on something like this and actually testing this out,
right,
and making a positive change. But well, no, I think it just goes to what you were saying, where it's like full circle. Where you,
I don't know if that would be. What do you mean a positive change in the meals?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, I definitely think, and what's also really interesting about Disney and only somewhat related is that a few years ago at Epcot, they were going to create a ride, a quote-unquote ride or an experience type. A lot of the rides at Disney are more like experiences, on healthy lifestyles. And it was like some type of video game that you went through and you helped, you had to fight off, like, different characters who were bad habits. I'm using air quotes, characters, air quotes, bad habits, air quotes. And the characters were like overweight or obese. And then you had to kind of like slim them down with these two, you got to be one of these two personal trainer characters. And after they announced that they were starting this ride, the blog Weighty Matters, which is written by Dr. Yoni Friedhoff in Canada, covered it and was like, this is not okay. We can't be villainizing people who are overweight or obese and making them, quote unquote, you know, the people who have bad habits. They're not, you know, people who are overweight. It's not a, it's not a series of bad habits.
True.
Right?
But don't you think that, so.
And anyway, the ride got shut down within 48 hours.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, but they were like, they scrapped the project.
And I guess it's not exactly villainizing them, but in a less, maybe less explicit way, isn't that kind of what the movie WALL-E was about?
No.
That was a big portion of it.
No, that
it
was
wasn't
not
fully
what,
about,
that
I'm not,
not
saying they were
what
villainized.
WALL-E was about.
That was a big component of it.
No.
The humans,
well,
what
WALL-E,
they had become.
No, yeah, but that was because of, so I.
It wasn't very positive.
In my mind, the difference between, WALL-E was not eat right and exercise. WALL-E was, this is what happens when
when you don't eat right or exercise?
No, no. I can't believe that's what you would think it was about. The planet was literally
no, the
covered
planet.
In trash.
No, I'm saying I'm not talking about that part of the story.
I see what you mean, that everybody was obese and they floated in
hovercraft. In virtual reality.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I didn't think about that. And
there's a scene with the captain running and he can't run.
Right. And you think about how... But I think that what that was about creating a human environment that we're so not adapted to that we essentially... disable ourselves, which I think is not the wrong way to think about the obesity epidemic. We've created an environment that's quote unquote obesogenic that even when you're trying to do your best and live your best life, you have to be actively fighting off your environment in order to not succumb to the chronic diseases that come with overconsumption. And I think that Wally was, you know, here, let's take it to the extreme end. What happens when we just continue to build this toxic environment? And then, you know, we have to fly into space with essentially a Walmart, like on a big Walmart ship and float around and drink all our food. But I definitely see what you're saying, where like potentially they make fun of like obesity, which I didn't really think about. And the other kind of Pixar movie that does the same thing, I hate to say, is I've, not to completely segue, but I noticed that in Inside Out as well, was that the two sort of negative characters, disgust and sadness, had slightly heavier figures, and joy was like very light.
Not disgust, it was anger. Disgust was
anger was heavier, yeah. And then you know, joy was like lithe and slim. And obviously everyone was a little bit modeled after the actors who played them, but also you were kind of like, well, why do we think that?
Right.
You know, like why do we associate that body size or that look with negative emotions, negative feelings, negative actions. But with the whole Disney thing, you know, it's just to go back to the research, apparently kind of what happened is Disney contacted the authors and was like, can you please withdraw this study? Can you please now publish this study? And the lead editor of the journal, Brian Wansink out of Cornell, I believe, was like, we can't pull the study at this point. It's too late. And they kind of explained to Disney, because Disney, I suppose, had never funded a scientific study before, which I didn't realize, but they hadn't funded a scientific study before. So they didn't realize, like, no, actually, this isn't how it works. You don't get to decide whether or not a study gets published. You have to just go with it once you fund it, because that's kind of how usually all the IRB agreements go, and then the agreements that the university or the scientists will sign with the industry is that, you know, you're not allowed to influence the results, you're not allowed to influence the outcome, and you're not allowed to determine whether or not the outcomes get published. But I thought that was a really interesting story because, you know, I think that we worry so much about industry funding studies to show things in their favor, and we worry a lot about, well, we're not going to be able to find out the truth because the industry's only going to fund studies that's going to make them look good. They're not going to fund the studies that don't make them look good. But we didn't think about, you know, drawing that conclusion to its more extreme end and showing, oh, wow, actually, we might convince industry that it's not worth it to fund in science because if the PR blowback is going to be so big, you know, they're not, you know, they're better off not having any answers. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I just thought that was a really kind of interesting story and a very different way of looking at the way that research gets funded.
Definitely. And he was not the only nutrition so-called expert that has been in the news recently for some controversy about censorship or being pulled off of things or having their presence requested to be revoked. Do you want to talk about what happened with Nina?
No.
Okay. we don't have to talk about that.
I'll talk a little bit about so there was an article that came out recently called The Sugar Conspiracy, The Great Sugar Conspiracy. I know a lot of people have seen it. I've seen it floating around Facebook a little bit and kind of tells the story of a researcher who I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to have to do a little bit of PubMed digging for next week so I can follow up on this. But who had posited back in the 60s and 70s that our real problem was sugar. So the problem wasn't fat. The problem wasn't
John Yudkin.
Yes, Dr. Yudkin, and that he thought the real problem was sugar, and he published a book called Sweet, White, and Deadly. I think, and basically the idea was he got laughed out of town, and that at the same time, this was during the rise of the idea of Ansel Keys, who was an epidemiologist, and Ansel Keys's whole idea was that eating saturated fat raises your cholesterol, and raising your cholesterol increases your risk for heart disease. And so the article kind of frames it as like this epic battle, but Ansel Keys had the politicians in his pocket, and he had this number of advantages, and so he just kind of defeated and buried John Yudkin in the sand, and now we're just discovering about it later. But I think if anybody has really kind of been in the nutrition scene for a pretty long time, you probably would have heard of Dr. Yudkin. I know that when Robert Lustig did his talk on sugar, I think it was called Sugar, the Bitter Truth, that went viral. I mean, he talked about Dr. Yudkin. So his name has been popping up a lot more in the news recently. But I also think that this is the kind of article that can be a little frustrating because you realize that when people tell stories about what happened, they're framing a very specific narrative, and they have a very specific story to tell. And so the story is really, really interesting. But of course, you have to realize that there are a lot of people who are around during that time and might have different ideas. And so they talk about how the dietary guidelines in 1980 were based on these ideas of Ansel Keys, and they say, I'm quoting from the story, which is by Ian Leslie. Thank you. He says, we replaced steak and sausages with pasta and rice, butter with margarine and vegetable oils, eggs with Wesley, I don't know how to say that word, and milk with low-fat milk or an orange juice. But instead of becoming healthier, we grew fatter and sicker. Well, if you were at Dr. Katz's mm-hmm. talk yesterday, you know that we didn't replace anything with anything. Yep. The guidelines came out,
and people,
yeah, and people continued to eat more. And as Dr. Katz explained, and hopefully we'll kind of be able to revisit. You know, Ansel Keys wasn't around to be endorsing, he wasn't endorsing Snackwells, right? Just like Dr. Atkins wasn't endorsing low-carb brownies. This is another example from Dr. Katz's talk. And the other thing, too, is instead of becoming healthier, we grew fatter and sicker. Well, the dietary guidelines sort of came out at first with the idea of lowering heart disease risk, specifically, because there was a period of time in the 60s and 70s when, I mean, people were just dropping dead of heart disease. And the idea was, how can we create a diet that's going to lower heart disease risk? And now we have, you know, people can live for pretty long with heart disease. There's lower overall kind of mortality from heart disease. But that is a lot in part of more effective medication and smoking cessation. But at the same time, you have to think like, well, what was the endpoint they were going for initially? Because they weren't really trying to tackle an obesity epidemic, you know? And I just think that in general, the story is very interesting, but it's coming from a very specific point of view. I also would like to point out that in the 70s was also when Dr. Atkins came out with his book, and he did not go quietly into that good night. You know, he became a huge phenomenon. So, you know, I think the idea that one guy who doesn't like sugar kind of faded into obscurity and another guy who didn't like sugar became a huge kind of diet superstar doesn't really tell the same story as one time this guy didn't like sugar and they buried the truth. But that's my personal opinion.
It is a conspiracy.
It's not a conspiracy.
And real quick, because we got to play our song so we can set up our phone call, but singing the Tycholz was also disinvited from a panel. You know the details about that.
Oh, yes. So there was
mentioned this artist. She's obviously part of this whole thing.
Yeah, so there was a food policy panel that was going to be assembled at an event, and initially Nina Tycholz, who is kind of a major character in this story, who wrote Big Fat Surprise, was invited, and then I guess became disinvited. And there's not a lot of details. Obviously, a couple authors who she knows, I suppose, have written a few articles about that and why that happened, but I don't think there's been like an official statement from the actual event as to why that happened.
There's a petition to get her back on, though.
No, I think it didn't go through. But yeah, it got over 4,000 signatures. So, I think that there's a lot of social media buzz about kind of these controversies. And I think that probably, I imagine what Dr. Katz will talk about is that some of those controversies are a little manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Oh, okay.
Well, so yeah, we're going to hit up your song. This is going to be Mr. Wives with Our Own House. And then we'll be back with David Katz on an Unbalanced Breakfast, WMFO 91.5 FM.
Came in like the breeze, I felt it in my knees. Never will it leave, each day it is retrieved. Seems like yesterday, you're right.
Welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. You just heard the band Mr. Wives with Our Own House. That was Catherine's pick of the week.
Yep.
We can talk about that a little bit later on in the show, but right now, we are joined by a very special guest, Dr. David Katz. He is the founding director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center at Yale. He's also president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. He helped develop the Nouvel scoring system, a team which includes Walter Willett here at Harvard. He also established the True Health Initiative, which hopefully we'll be able to talk about, and has published over 200 articles and 15 books. Dr. David Katz, welcome to the show, and thank you very much for joining
us.
Well, nice to be with you guys. Thanks for having me. I don't know about this unbalanced breakfast business. we'll talk about that off air.
Sure. So, great. So, again, for people who don't know, Dr. Katz spoke yesterday at the Gershoff Symposium, part of the Tufts Friedman School Alumni Weekend. Unfortunately, an abbreviated talk, but touched on a lot of great stuff, including stuff that I'm very interested in. I thought it was awesome about communication around nutrition. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to throw it over to Catherine right now to get us started with some questions.
Yeah, so we definitely want to go more into the topic of your talk and the True Health Initiative. But to get started, many of our listeners are obviously students at the Friedman School. They're just starting out their careers in nutrition and healthcare. So I would love if you could reflect a little bit on your more early career trajectory, and then also, you know, what do you wish that you knew when you were starting out?
Sure. Well, thanks, Catherine. So in terms of my career trajectory, I started out thinking pretty conventionally about a medical career. My dad's a cardiologist. I saw him involved in life and death decision making when I was growing up and doing something that looked so important and so responsive to the most urgent kind of human need. I wanted to be in that space. And then when I was in my internal medicine residency, the fact that I have a brain that is pretty much naturally inclined to the big picture. You know, I'm one of those people who always sees the forest through the trees. Well, in medical training, the forest through the trees was lots of pathology that didn't need to happen. There we were, desperately trying to take care of horribly sick people. And it was pretty apparent to me that 8 times in 10, these were people who never needed to be that sick in the first place if they had used lifestyle as their medicine 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier, or ideally for their whole life. And I thought, well, you know, I do want to be the guy that you know, rushes in that moment of great need and provides help and succor. But I also would love to do something about preventing people from getting so sick in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on to a second residency in preventive medicine, and I focused preferentially on nutrition because I think it's so important. It touches us all every day. It has a major influence on health. And because although the other things on the list of lifestyle is medicine, physical activity, sleep, managing stress, they tend to be simpler. People understand just what to do. Nutrition was the space where, you know, we really needed innovation to help people understand, you know, what is the right answer. And then once we have the fundamentals of healthy eating widely disseminated, we still have enormous challenges in helping people get there from here.
Right.
And the rest is history. So I really focused on a combination of teaching, research, program development, patient care all these years. I've continued to do patient care for a span of 25 years, but more and more I've shifted the focus of my career to disease prevention and using lifestyle in particular, and in my case, strong emphasis on nutrition, to add years to lives and life to years and prevent chronic disease. And then in terms of what do I wish I knew then, I don't think there's anything. It's interesting, Catherine. I had a call from a young graduate student wanting advice about his career and thought, well, you know, if I can get some wisdom from somebody who's put in some miles, and asked me the same question. And I said, actually, I wish I didn't know right now what you don't know now. In other words, you know, there's a certain conviction at the start of your career and idealism, the belief that everything's possible. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the lessons you learn trying to get stuff done in the real world is that it's really hard. You know, I've personally brought in and managed something like $40 million in research funds over the years. But at the end of that, and so that sounds like success, and from the outside it looks like success, but from the inside what I can tell you is I've never been able to get funding for my most important, most innovative ideas. So it's hard, and I'm not wanting to discourage anybody, quite the contrary. What I'm saying is, as young people starting out in your career, frankly you should cherish the fact that you are filled with energy and the idealism of youth. And in many ways, I think that's your greatest asset. And you, therefore, are the greatest hope for the future. I mean, people who have the relevant training and expertise, but also just the convictions of youthful idealism, very important. I haven't lost mine, but, you know, a lot of years, they've taken a beating. And I found it generally takes, you know, maybe 10 times as long as it should to get something done, and you only ever wind up getting half of it done because the world won't let you do the rest, that sort of thing. I'm glad I didn't know it at the start. Everybody learns it along the way, but I think you want to jump in with both feet, and time can be the teacher there. I don't think there's anything I wish I knew 25 years ago that I know now. I was perfectly happy to learn it slowly over time. I do think it's important, obviously, to derive a benefit from experience. But you do that anyway. You've got access to the faculty, and you know you're getting good guidance from people who've gone those miles as well. But don't underestimate the great power and the critical importance of what freshness and youth brings to this enterprise of advancing the human condition. You're the greatest hope we've got.
Well, that was very inspiring. So thank you for definitely for touching on that. And I just wanted to ask, so you talked yesterday in your speech, which will be up online soon, so people will be able to watch it if they weren't there. You talked about the many signals that people get in the public about nutrition and how it can cause them to just kind of raise up their hands and not really make healthy changes. And I'm just wondering if you can reflect between the beginning of your career and now, do you really think that the noise has significantly increased? Like, what's the difference that you see in the messaging now from then?
The noise has massively increased, and I don't know that the attitudes of people have changed at all. It's probable that every expert always wanted to highlight his or her specific point of view, and there's always been competition to be heard. But the internet came along during my career. We didn't have it's shocking for young people, to imagine a world without the internet, but my career began in a world without the internet. I remember first hearing about email and thinking, who the hell needs that? we're talking about it was prehistoric, but it wasn't all that long ago. It's amazing. So, the advent of the internet and the blogosphere has changed everything.
Right.
Everybody is a journalist. And it used to be that journalism involved people trained in journalism and editorial oversight. And, there were certain places where you'd have to pass through filters if you wanted to be heard, but now everybody can blog, and there's some ominous implications of that. There was a piece in the Federalist within the last couple of years called "The Death of Expertise." Mm-hmm. The person writing it was a political scientist, but it pertains to all domains. If every opinion can be broadcasted into cyberspace and then echoed by followers and amplified, it becomes very difficult to know what is just opinion, what is actual expertise. That's a huge difference. And so the problem is somewhat, I think, exacerbated maybe by the fact that there are ever more scientists, ever more background noise, ever more struggle to be heard. But then whatever it is we have to say, once it gets out there, anybody who likes or dislikes it can twist it any way they want.
Right.
Can broadcast it to their own following via social media. And then it becomes a game of telephone. And this really was my commentary yesterday in the symposium, that this is a huge part of the whole e-informatics age. We lose control of the messages. They travel out. They take root in echo chambers. And unfortunately, we tend to be fairly divisive, right? So there are the people who are convinced that sugar is the root of all evil, and they've got their clan, and mm-hmm. there's the group that continues to think that fat is the root of all evil, and they're the ardent vegans, and they're the ardent paleos. Well, they've all formed their clubs, and they've all got Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts and LinkedIn and Pinterest and all the rest. Essentially, they take whatever message they like and they amplify it massively. They take any message they don't like and they beat up not just on the message, but on whoever was behind it. Sometimes that's me, whoever it is, they beat up on them in cyberspace and retweet one another endlessly. So these constant reverberations. So yes, we are drowning now in not just information, but misinformation.
Right.
There's a huge amount of noise. And, we're having this conversation on the radio. Well, the fundamental issue of having an audience being able to hear a radio show is signal-to-noise ratio, right? I mean, there's traditionally been an issue as you try to tune your radio dial. You want to get past any static, competing mm-hmm. channels, bandwidth issues, so forth. So you want a loud enough signal, and you want to minimize the static.
Right.
Well, we've got enormous static. Particularly on the topic of nutrition. And it becomes increasingly difficult for any one of us, no matter how good our credentials, no matter how sound our judgment, to be heard above the din. That's an enormous problem for our culture.
So I have a follow-up to that, specifically because Friedman has a nutrition communication program. So I'm wondering if you have an idea or any recommendation. Is there, for nutrition communicators, is there a unique position for them to take leadership, or do they have a certain responsibility, do you see, to kind of cut through the static and cut the noise, or do you think they're in danger of being drowned out by the static? Do they need
becoming
to,
static?
Or yeah.
So all of those, that essentially yes to all of those. Huge, potential power, huge potential responsibility, could easily become part of the problem, mm-hmm. and so forth. So let me sort of jump ahead. You were going to ask me about the True Health Initiative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. I mean, I spent yesterday with Dean Mosafarian, who's a good friend, and with Alice Lichtenstein, who's obviously an esteemed colleague. And I had lunch with Alice, and then spent some time later in the day talking with Darry. And neither one of them hides the fact that they've got some significant disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, one of the things we talked about is, yeah, but when it's time to have a meal, the three of us, knowing what we know, all eat food that have a meal that's much more like one another's than any of our meals would be anything like the typical American diet.
Right.
So, the tendency for all nutrition experts is to kind of fall in love with that area where we do all our work and devote our hours and our passion, and then to talk about that. And it's the differentiating thing, right? So, makes me unique is not what I have in common with everybody else who knows something about nutrition. It's the specific work that I do. But if I talk about my specific point of view, and Alice talks about hers, and Darry talks about his, and we all do that, the public perception is that no two nutrition experts agree about anything. So we don't really know what good nutrition is, so I'm not even going to worry about it. I'll be at Burger King.
Right.
We all have an obligation to make sure that we raise the floor. If we want to lift the ceiling, we have to work out our differences. So, what right. is the best answer about specific fatty acids and so forth and all of that? Do we know which specific diet is best for human health or the environment and all of that? We can work that out. That's what we do.
Right.
But we've got to raise the floor mm-hmm. so that, basically nobody's in the sub-basement. And the way we do that is by making perfectly clear that there is a massive agreement among just about everybody who knows anything about mm-hmm. nutrition, about the fundamentals of healthy eating. I think we all agree
right.
with Michael Pollan that our diet should be real food, not stuff that glows in the dark, and mostly plants. So, good diets all include lots of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, typically nuts and seeds, and water when thirsty, not Coca-Cola or Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't come together to convey that message, all the public hears is the discord, the disagreement. And again, not only does that invite them to divide up into competing camps, but it invites them to distrust us all because it says, hey, you claim to be experts, but you don't even agree with one another about anything.
Right.
And so we're propagating distrust at best and disgust at worst, and we're risking the public tuning us all out. So the True Health Initiative is my attempt to overcome that problem. It is a coalition. The leadership of the True Health Initiative is a coalition of 300 leading experts and influencers in the lifestyle space. Mm-hmm. With a particular focus on nutrition from 30 countries.
I just want to jump in and point out that that Park Wilde and Diane McKay and Dean Mosafarian are all, and Dr. Bloomberg are all kind of on that coalition.
They are, mm-hmm. exactly. So we've got a strong Tufts contingent, mm-hmm. and we stand together with colleagues from all of the illustrious universities all around the world, as well as luminaries in the culinary world like Sam Katz, who is the White House chef, and Alice Waters. Titans of the biomedical industry like Toby Cosgrove, who's CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, household names like Sanjay Gupta. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And the real beauty of it, Catherine, is we've got people there who range in their work and their devotions literally from vegan to paleo. So the world-leading proponents of a vegan diet like Neil Barnard, T. Colin Campbell, Caldwell Esselstyn, Dean Ornish, they're all on this panel. They're all on the council, and on that same council, saying we agree about the fundamentals of healthy living and healthy eating are the leading experts on the paleo diet,
right.
Boyd Eaton, Mel Konner, Lauren Cordain.
Right.
And so I would encourage anybody who is up and coming in the world of nutrition and working to cultivate a particular expertise and obviously having their own particular passions to see the forest through the trees.
Right.
If we want to help the public, the public needs to trust that nutrition expertise means something. And we can know when we argue with one another that we agree about a lot more. But the public won't know if all they ever hear is the disagreement. We need to band together. I invite everyone listening to visit truehealthinitiative.org to see what we're about, and to join us. I mean, if you agree that there's a need to convey a fundamental understanding of healthy eating to the public, you can sign up and become a member, and in unity, there is strength. And frankly, there may only be the strength we need to rise above the din and the discord in our unity, and then we can take back control of the messaging. Just last week, there was a paper out from a group in Cornell, and all that paper really was about was the fact that people who are part of populations that have been vegetarian for many generations show genetic adaptations, genetic mutations, that make them better at deriving optimal nutrition from a vegetarian diet. And by extension, if you come from a population that's been vegetarian for a long time and you deviate from that to a modern Western diet, a typical American diet, if you will, that the harms of that modern diet may be even greater. This was massively distorted in headlines saying vegetarian diets cause increased risk of cancer and heart disease. Nothing could have been further from the truth.
Right.
And I actually spoke directly with the senior author of the paper to say, am I missing something here? He said, absolutely not. I've never seen such wild distortions in the headlines. Well, that does enormous damage, but if we stand united as a community in defense of the fundamentals of good nutrition, healthy eating, I think we can overcome that. If we are divided by, you know, our competing points of view, and that's what the public hears, then they become putty in the hands of these hyperbolic prone journalists, and there is just massive confusion, and that is a formula for lack of progress.
Right.
And let's be clear, you know, as we get to the end of our discussion this morning, let's be clear, and you guys know this, but everybody listening needs to know it as well. We have known for decades how to use lifestyle and diet to prevent as much as 80% of the total chronic disease burden in the world. Let's make no mistake here. We have the knowledge to prevent unbelievable sums of human misery. We have the knowledge to add years to lives around the globe. We have the knowledge to add life to years. And we're failing to translate that knowledge into the power of routine action. It is our obligation to use what we know. Lives are literally at stake. And it's the common knowledge, the shared knowledge, the fundamentals of healthy living, healthy eating, that have that potential to eradicate 80% of all chronic disease. It's not the esoterica. So we can have this cake and eat it too. We can propagate a common understanding of the fundamentals, even as we, being experts, you know, debate the smaller points. But we can't let the pursuit of what we don't know interfere with the use of what we do know and what we have known for literal decades. This is, I think, the mandate in front of all of us. Let's use what we know. It's as if the House of Public Health had been on fire for 25 years and we all had fire hoses, but instead of spraying a drop of water to put out the fire, we're bickering over who's got the right caliber hose or the right kind of water. We don't spray a drop and we let the house burn down. Put out the fire.
And just to bolster your point, we don't want to take up too much of your time. We know you're on your way heading out, but just to bolster your point, you know when you look at, you're talking about all the people that agree, when you look at the Boyd Eaton, the Lauren Cordain, you know, Neil Barnard, T. Colin Campbell, when you look at the actual scientists who are advocating a specific way of eating, those people are all very much in agreement. And it's what you, like what you said, the echo chamber and kind of that game of telephone that winds up distorting it and making it seem like everybody is very different. But in essentials, the people who actually do the science and understand the nutrition are, for the most part, in alignment. And then have
There is some legitimate disagreement, too, but stunningly little. You know, again, when I set out to form the True Health Initiative, I was testing a hypothesis. I thought, you know, can I get paleo experts and vegan experts to stand up and be counted in public and say we actually agree much more than we disagree? You know, basically, given the option, you know, the vegans will take their plate and fill it up with vegetables and fruits and whole grains, and their protein source will be beans and lentils, and the paleo experts will fill their plate with all the same thing.
Right.
Except the beans and lentils, they'll have wild salmon or grass-fed beef or bison there. But you look at those two plates, you say, okay, mostly plants both kinds, and you know, all wholesome foods direct from nature, and nothing that glows in the dark, and nothing that looks remotely like the typical American diet.
Right.
The typical American doesn't know that. They think vegan and paleo are opposite ends of a spectrum. They're not. Mm-hmm. They're actually clustered together at the end of the spectrum. It's about wholesome foods in sensible combinations. And the other end of the spectrum is a diet of multicolored marshmallows as part of a complete breakfast, i.e. the typical American diet. And we need to move people away from that. Sadly, the SAD diet, the standard American diet, is little by little taking over the world. The world's moving in the wrong direction. There is a big challenge and an enormous opportunity in front of us all. And again, really, I think we're counting on the passion, the conviction that I saw yesterday here at Tufts among young people who recognize the power of food as medicine to help us overcome the obstacles and do the good that we can do in the world.
Yeah, very inspiring. Yeah, and good job, Friedman.
Yes.
All right.
Good job indeed. Yeah. Guys, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yep, thank you very much for joining us. So again, that was Dr. David Katz, and you can check out the website for True Health Initiative at truehealthinitiative.org. You can also check out Dr. Katz's own website at davidkatzmd.com. All right, so we are going to take our second song break of the day here, and then when we come back, we are going to touch on the topic that we teased earlier and do a little quiz about cannibalism. So stay tuned. Any last-minute phone calls here?
Also not part of a healthy diet.
Right. Number 617-627-3800. Here are the Street Dogs, who you can see later in the summer, with I thought would be a fitting song based on a little bit of what we just talked about. You're listening to an Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
It's a medical breakthrough. Doctors are prescribing something new to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't get it filled at the pharmacy. The answer is as close as your local supermarket. That's right. Research has shown that a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, beans, whole grains, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods protects against cancer and can even help survival rates. Side effects of a vegetarian diet include increased energy, lower cholesterol levels, and better overall health. And with the right recipes, a high-fiber vegetarian diet can be a delicious way to help shed those unwanted pounds. So, stock up today. For a free nutrition booklet filled with delicious cancer-fighting recipes, visit cancerproject.org or call 866-906-WELL. That's 866-906-WELL. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project, committed to preventing cancer and improving survival.
And welcome back to an Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Before that PSA, you heard the Street Dogs with Too Much Information. That's off their eponymous album, which came out, which was like the fourth or fifth that they released. Again, you can see those guys this summer were Sick of It All. Very exciting show. And do you want to talk about your song selection real quick that we played earlier?
That's the band Mr. Wives. I like them. They were at Boston Calling in the fall, which is where I saw them. And I guess you can tell I like more pop music. than Matt does.
Yeah, we have very different styles, which it brings everything together quite well.
Yeah.
All right, so we've mentioned at the top of the show, talked about it a couple times. Again, back when Curtis, I believe, was on in the show a few weeks ago, we jokingly brought up the topic of cannibalism. Why don't you recap it for us real quick about how it came up?
Oh, okay, yeah. So I wish that this was what nutrition school is about, actually. I was really sad. But I was in line at, you know, Sweetgreen with a couple of my friends, and I said something like, oh, I'm studying nutrition science. And the guy was like, oh, nutrition. Awesome. Okay, first question, cannibalism. And that was not a question. It was a word. And I had to kind of apologize and be like, you know, I actually don't study that. We don't really consider that part of nutrition.
It's not a concentration at the school.
It's not a concentration at the school. So, yeah. And then he proceeded to ask me a couple questions, one of which was, can you eat by only looking at the sun? Which luckily I knew the answer to. No, you cannot.
Have you seen the stories about the human Barbie dolls? And
I have, and the people they can eat, they're like breatharians or air or something. Yeah, I mean, they can't, so I don't know what else to say other than that's not true, but...
All right, so...
But that was an easy one.
Not get too off
cannibalism,
topic.
Cannibalism, not easy.
Yeah, so we jokingly said, oh, that could be a good topic of research or topic for a show, and I then took it seriously and went and researched it. Of course, being a fan of horror movies, a couple of the more infamous ones have gotten people almost arrested for some of the things that's been depicted. Check out Cannibal Holocaust, but don't watch Cannibal Ferox because that's a little too much. But anyway, so I looked up some facts, some nutrition facts about nutrition, and there has been some research done, and I'm going to see how much Catherine knows about the topic.
There's been research done?
Oh, yeah.
Like anthropological research?
Yes.
Or like, oh, okay.
So in fact, I'll say true or false.
Oh, gosh.
Throughout his, well, I won't.
I feel like I'm going to look bad if I'm wrong, but like really bad if I'm right.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's no win situation here for
yeah.
you. So true or false? Cannibalism has been used for a source of nutrition in the course of history. Not ritual.
Okay.
Actual nutrition.
I'm going to say true only because I'm thinking of the Donner Party.
Okay. Yeah. I should have clarified it wasn't that. I mean, that was out of necessity. Same thing with the...
you mean like supplementing? Like I'm going to have a healthy diet and then I'm going to supplement with a little...
Maybe not even supplementation. Could have been the whole diet.
I would say false.
The answer could still be true.
Oh.
So Homo antecessor, which is the, this is how poor my science background is. Is that a species or is that a...
Oh my gosh, I have no idea.
So anyway, between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, Homo antecessor, there is actual evidence that they probably did resort to cannibalism for nutrition based on some of the bones and things that have been dug up. And they think that that was actually a thing that they did.
As like part of their regular diet?
As part of their regular diet,
oh,
yep.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yikes.
So there's that. And then, so some more of the research has been done. Do you know, well, we talked about this the other day, but we'll see if you remember. It has been estimated, this was based on body composition data from 4 deceased males, approximately how many calories would be found in a human body?
Okay, yeah, this I think we chatted about and I think that I disagreed with. Okay, so a human male,
mm-hmm.
So are we saying like an American male?
I believe they were American.
Okay, so let's say you have a human male and he is like 200 pounds. I don't know how much somebody's skeleton weighs. But let's say it's like, I don't know. Now I'm going to really not know how long. Like, I don't know, like 60 pounds. So 140 pounds. Like three. I don't know. I would think you'd be like 30,000 or 40,000 calories.
Okay. So that is far under the estimate of 81,500 calories.
Oh,
total.
I went way under.
Mm-hmm. And what body part would offer the most calories, do you think?
Your leg, mm-hmm. right?
Do you know how many?
What?
Do you know how many calories a leg would have?
You said it was 7,500, but I thought it would be way more than
7,100.
That.
7,100 calories, 1,800 in the arm.
But I just don't understand, how would you have 80,000 calories in your whole body, but only 7,000 calories in your leg, which is a huge part of your body? I guess I imagine your liver would be pretty energy. Like, I imagine your viscera would be pretty energy dense.
Right.
And your brain.
Although not healthy for you, apparently. Because you know how, like, chicken liver or whatever is, like, really recommended as
yes.
a good source? Apparently not human liver because of all the waste products.
Oh.
Which I also found while researching this.
I believe that.
Do you know
that chickens, though, their waste products would also be in their livers?
That's true.
But maybe it's because it's, like, specific to humans or mm-hmm. something like that.
And then, wait, did you mention the brain?
The brain would be really energy dense, is all I...
Yes. And then we had this argument. So, Ashley, why don't we... this is a question I had. So obviously, animal products aren't known for their carbohydrate content.
Right.
That they basically have none.
They don't have it.
So all nutrition facts of the human body that have been compiled and estimated are based on fat and protein.
Mm-hmm.
But I also read something that said that the brain has glucose in it. So can you explain to us, would the brain or the human body or the blood, your blood sugar, would that actually be a source of carbohydrates?
Okay, so if you're a BMN student and you're listening and I butcher this, I'm really sorry. But yes, your brain would have some sugar in it. Your liver would have glycogen in it. Your blood would have sugar in it. So your red blood cells in your brain function primarily on glucose. So essentially what happens is even if you're starving, your body needs to produce glucose to feed your brain. So there is always going to be a certain amount of sugar in your body. However, when you die, all your cells aren't going to turn off at once, right? So your heart stops beating, you stop breathing, but your cells are going to die almost like in a they're not going to all die at once, right? And so what would probably happen, I imagine, is that by the time you were really and truly dead, the cells in your body would have metabolized any of the actual carbohydrate that existed. And I honestly am not 100% sure that that's true, but I would think that that would explain the zero carb thing. And also, even if you did keep all of that sugar, I mean, it's not like you're full of sugar.
Right. So what you're saying is, though, a vampire may be able to benefit.
Well, yeah, that's what we were wondering. Like, if you were mainlining it from somebody who was alive, would you be digesting their blood glucose? And I would think that you would.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now let's get to the policy side of cannibalism.
Yes.
True or false?
There are policies about
cannibalism. True or false? There is a law on the books in the United States that prohibits cannibalism or against cannibalism.
Okay. True. Because I would think that would be something on a corpse, mutilating a corpse or something.
Well, so it's false because technically there is no actual law against it. But yes, what you're touching on is most people are either going to, depending on what happens, either going to be charged with murder, desecration of a corpse, or some other potential crimes. In fact, so about a decade ago, there was the infamous German case. Just real simple. The German courts had a lot of difficulty coming up with what they were going to charge the guy with.
Oh, what you charge someone with?
Yep.
Oh, gosh.
Do you want me to ask you the question about comparing it to what it tastes like? Do you want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, go for it, okay. Matt. You should see Matt's face right now. He's like so giddy. I'm nauseous.
What common food has human flesh been compared to?
I know the answer, though, because you already told me. Pork.
Pork, yes. Again, you can research the rest of that on your own.
Not surprising. But
and then, do you know the name of... So basically, again, we are not endorsing the practice of cannibalism. And one of many reasons why... So true or false, cannibalism is healthy for yourself. If you practice cannibalism.
False. That would be false.
Very false. And one of the main reasons is it leads to kuru. I don't know how you say that word. But it's a disease very similar to mad cow disease. And you get it from eating infected proteins called prions, which there's a lot in the brain. So again, even though the brain maybe nutritionally could be good in that way, it's going to put you at very high risk of death, basically.
Right.
Because when you have kuru, this is my frame of reference. Have you ever seen the movie Book of Eli with Denzel Washington?
No.
it's a good movie. But they're constantly, so it's like post-apocalyptic world, and they're constantly looking at each other's hands, and there's one scene where they run into an old couple, and they're invited to dinner, and the couple's hands are shaking, and that's because they are suffering from kuru because they have resorted to cannibalism in that state. And actually, it's why there's a tribe in Papua New Guinea that is one of the last known groups that had been practicing ritualistic cannibalism, and now they're getting away from that because they have been dying off, actually, from this disease. So the moral of the story is don't practice cannibalism, but there is research. There's a 90-page dissertation that's been done exploring this mostly from an anthropological point of view, but also has some interesting science and nutrition facts for you, including nutrition table about the different parts of the human
goodness,
body.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe that exists.
Yep, so it is out there. Go and Google it.
All right.
Go forth and explore and ask questions is what we do as scientists. And that's one of the questions that has been asked and attempted to be answered. And so we're going to end on that note.
Yeah.
We will be back next week with Ashley Colpott from the Food Corridor talking. So she will be calling in. Until then, have a great week.
Yes.
And we
eat a balanced breakfast.
Eat a balanced breakfast.
And check out True Health Initiative.
Yes.
Yeah.
We will see you. Have a great week. Stay tuned for Mike on the Mic. Goodbye.
Bye.